There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
This episode is sponsored by Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races in West Virginia. Upcoming featured entertainment includes The Steel Woods on April 26th and Little River Band on May 3rd. Details and tickets at HollywoodCasinoCharlestown.com. Must be 21 to enter the casino floor and attend a show. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Welcome to the newest episode of Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. I'm your host, Jason Fraley, picking the brains of the top filmmakers, musicians, and artists of our time. Grammy-winning and Oscar-nominated composer Terrence Blanchard brings his acclaimed opera concert, Fire Shut Up In My Bones, to Strathmore in North Bethesda, Maryland this Friday night. He joined me to preview the performance as well as reflect on his iconic film scores. From Spike Lee's Malcolm X and Black Klansman to Casey Lemon's Eve's Bayou and Harriet to Gina Prince Bythewood's Love and Basketball and The Woman King.
Hello?
Hey, Terrence Blanchard. Hey, thanks so much for joining us again on WTOP in D.C.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Now, we last spoke in, I guess you came and played Frederick, Maryland at the Weinberg Center. It was like in 2021. And I think at that time, it was like a month after you had just performed Fire Shut Up In My Bones at the New York, the Metropolitan Opera. I think it made you actually the first Black composer to ever stage an opera there. So it was like a historic deal right when you joined us last time. So this time you're coming to Strathmore Friday, April 26th. And that's the exact piece, the Fire Shut Up In My Bones. That's what you're playing this time at Strathmore, right?
Yeah, we're going to do like we have a concert version of it. Obviously, we won't have the production sets and wardrobe, but it's a very beautiful concert. You know, to hear the arias done in that setting is a totally different type of experience.
Not like the theatrics and costumes and everything of like a, you know, a full on opera, but it's still the same great music that you'll be doing in sort of like a concert version. Well, that's cool.
Exactly. Plus, you don't want to hear me sing anyway. So,
oh, come on, just for this show.
No, there's not enough alcohol in the U.S. for me to do that. But it's still going to be a lot of fun. And it's going to be, you know, we've done it a couple of times and it's really a great show.
Well, there's not enough alcohol in the U.S. for you to sing, but who will be singing? You know, tell us who's going to be there. There's some cool artists that's going to be on the stage with you.
Oh, man, I can't think of Justin's last name, but Justin and Adrian are going to be there. I mean, two amazing vocalists that are just at the top of their game. Justin just did Champion, the opera in Chicago. It's a Chicago Lyric. And Adrian she's been the cover for all of the productions at the Met, and we took her out on the road because she's an amazing vocalist.
Yeah, it's Justin Austin and Adrian Danrich, I think is how you say it.
Danrich, Justin Austin and Adrian Danrich are going to be the vocalists, yeah.
Awesome. They'll be belting to the rafters there at Strathmore. And also, you know, musically, it's like the E Collective, Turtle Island Quartet, and Andrew F. Scott will be joining you as well. So
that's cool. I mean, you know, those are my mainstay guys. The E Collective and Turtle Island and myself, we've been playing together now for about 2 or 3 years, and it's been amazing. And Andrew Fitzgerald Scott is a friend of mine that grew up with in Brooklyn, who's a visual artist who does all of the imagery behind us on stage, and he's been phenomenal at doing that. I think what people should really know is that when we're doing the shows, when we're doing the concerts, he's creating all of that stuff live.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Well, that's like the musicians and singers that'll be performing with you. And I know it's like Washington Performing Arts is co-producing this with Strathmore. So that's like the music. But sort of take me sort of like the premise, the story sort of behind the songs that we hear, you know, how the memoir that it's based on, the libretto by a very famous filmmaker as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's taken from the opera, which is about Charles Blow's life, taken from his memoirs of the same name, Fire Shut Up In My Bones. And, you know, really, the thing that I love about doing this concert is that you get a sense of what has happened throughout Charles's life and how people have reacted to it. The arias themselves are the major portions of what you would see in the production. The libretto was written by, you know, and like almost like a family friend of me now. We've been so close together, Casey Lemons. We've done a number of film projects. The last one that we've done together was Harriet Tubman.
Oh, yeah.
And, I called her in to do this libretto, and she did a fantastic and amazing job. So hopefully, you know, when you experience this concert, you get a very broad sense musically of what you would experience if you saw the opera live.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah. And Casey Lemons, I mean, you mentioned Harriet, which I really enjoyed. Great performance by Cynthia Erivo to your music, but also Casey Lemons. I know you all worked on Eve's Bayou, which, man, that was one of the most powerful movies probably of the entire 90s. That came out in 97. We just spoke with Lynn Whitfield in depth about that one. What a great movie.
That was a great experience too. That was our first project together.
Wow. Well, there you go, folks. All of those great talents sort of all woven into this Fire Shut Up In My Bones that you're going to hear at Strathmore. That's cool. That's cool. Well, in addition to that, you know, whenever I have someone, you know, as iconic as yourself on, I mean, you're a legend in this industry, as far as I'm concerned. I love to remind folks of your, you know, your superhero origin story. I know you're born in New Orleans in like what, 62. Yeah. Didn't you? Yeah, I believe last time you told us you grew up like with the Marsalis brothers, right?
Yeah, yeah, I grew up with those guys. Yeah. No, those are my boys. That's like my family, man. We've been knowing each other since elementary school. We went to summer music camp together at Loyola University when I was going to fifth grade. I think Wynton was going to sixth grade. So we've been knowing each other for a long time.
Right. Right. And I think you said you originally, you know, when you were younger, you were dreamed of being a pro football player, but you pivoted into music.
You know, it's funny about that. I really didn't pivot into music as much as I was shoved because my father stopped me from playing football.
Oh, there you go.
which is a good thing, man. I'm 5'9", bro. I wouldn't have made it anyway. So, you know, it's better that I became a musician.
There you go. Well, all right. So not a pivot, a shove. There you go. I love it. well, then how did you actually, you know, start pursuing it, you know, more seriously? Like, you know, didn't you go to, you know, New Orleans Center of Creative Arts, Rutgers University? Yeah. Like, how did that training sort of, you think, set you off to the races?
Well, you know, it was always a part of my life. You know, from the time that I was 5 years old, my parents had me taking piano lessons. And I had three piano teachers, and my final piano teacher, Roger Dickinson, was the guy who also became my composition teacher. And then from there, I just went to Rutgers University, where I started playing with Lionel Hampton while I was still in school, and then progressed to play with Art Blakey, and things just kind of progressed. So music was always a big part of my life. It's just that when sports, from the time that I was a little kid, was taken from me, you know, the music just occupied a larger space in my life. Yeah. And just became the focal point of everything that I've done, you know, or everything that I wanted to do. You know, I've been blessed, man, having great teachers and having great experiences being in great bands. And now, even now, man, I'm traveling with my band as well, but I'm on the road with Herbie Hancock right now. And that's been like an amazing experience as well, you know, playing with him for the last few years.
I mean, come on, Herbie's calling and enjoying this. Not to mention, he, you know, every couple years at the Kennedy Center Honors, he always comes back the red carpet. I mean, man, what an incredible musician. I mean, getting a tour with, man, Terrence Blanchard and Herbie Hancock. Get whenever you can see those shows, folks, get tickets to that too. That's that's once in a lifetime. All right, cool. Well, I mean, just I'm in the sense of trying to move somewhat chronologically. So then you did that Terrence Blanchard, Donald Harrison quintet, and then you went solo. Like by the time we reached the 90s, mm-hmm. signed by Columbia Records, Grammy nods, 5 wins.
We have 7 wins actually.
Seven.
Yeah, because the last two were with the opera. Both productions of my operas at the Met won Grammys the last 2 years.
Well, there you go. So 5 wins last time we spoke, but 2 more since then. Every time you call in, let's just add a couple more.
Okay. Yeah.
But what was it? What was it like getting that first one at least?
I think the first one was for Tale of God's Will. Yeah, but it was an amazing experience. Obviously, you know, something that I didn't expect, even though I was nominated. You know, whenever you win those types of whenever you're acknowledged in that way, it's always a blessing and it's always an honor. You know, I don't take it lightly, you know, because there are a lot of great musicians who are out there doing great work, you know, so it's not like, you know, I'm standing so far above the crowd. You know, there are a lot of great musicians who I really admire and I'm inspired by, you know, so when you're acknowledged in that way, I just take it as a huge honor, and I'm very blessed to be a part of the entire experience.
All right, well then, so how do you, a lot of us know you for, I mean, we mentioned Casey Lemons, but a lot of us know you for your long collaboration with Spike Lee. How did that meeting actually happen? Wasn't it something like a sports rivalry, Lakers-Knicks?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was first hired to play on the session, I walked into the session, you know, with some Laker gear on, and he obviously noticed me. He goes, "Laker fan, huh?" I'm like, "Yeah, whatever." You know what I mean? But then after that, man, once we started to become friends, he started taking me to Knick games. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm over there going, "Take him, Pat," just like he would do.
Yeah.
Because I became a Knick fan at that point. I'm still a Laker fan for sure.
Yeah.
But that's how it all started, you know. And then that's how my relationship with him started. But then the scoring thing started with just me playing the piano and him hearing something that I was doing. And he asked if he could use them, then asked if I could write a string arrangement for it. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, you were. So I know, because I know, you know, his dad, his late father, I guess Bill Lee just passed away.
Yeah, Bill Lee.
Was the official composer on Do the Right Thing. But you worked on it as like a session musician, right? Early on that film, right? And could you tell that was going to be like the one? I mean, there's many. Spike has made some masterpieces, but that is like the masterpiece of the masterpieces.
No, it was hard to tell back then because you got to remember, you know, Spike had such a unique cinematic style. You know, we were learning it just as much as anybody else. I mean, we knew that it was great. We knew that it was like really compelling because we were seeing ourselves and our culture on the screen, you know, but to see what it's meant to people over the years is still something that you couldn't have foreseen.
Absolutely. So then what's it like then for you to actually, you know, you were a session musician on that, but then finally getting tapped to like, you know, create the actual full original, you know, the titled composer for, what was it, Mo Better Blues and Jungle Fever? Like those were you actually start scoring for that. So what was that like when Spike finally is like, okay, this session musician, I think he can actually do the whole damn thing. What was it like to get that, you know, vote of confidence for those?
Oh man, that was that was an overwhelming experience at first, but just because of the amount of music that I had to write. You know what I mean? But it's one of those things, you know, when you get excited about a project, you don't really think about that as much. You think about doing the best job that you can possibly do.
Yeah.
So everything becomes really important. Every scene, every note, every orchestrational choice becomes a very important thing. And then the next thing you know, you're done. What I had to learn was, you know, that each project had its own signature sound and its own approach. And that was the beautiful thing about working with Spike, because he would always challenge me in that regard. He would always say things like, "So what haven't we done yet, you know, in a score?" And that would cause me to think about new ideas. So when we got time to do something like Black Klansman, we wound up using my electric band as the foundation for the score and featured the guitarist and my man, Charles Altura.
I'm telling you that you mentioned Black Klansman. That score is, there's not too many I can say this about. There's not too many movies where I hear the score and years later, it's still echoing in my head. What's it been, 6 years now? I can still, just tell me the title Black Klansman and I can immediately pull it and go, bam, da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. I mean, come on. There's not many that can just instantly come to mind. Tell me about creating that. How you come up with that? It's genius.
Well, you know, part of it was just like, you know, watching what Spike had already done visually. You know, the thing about working with Spike is that whenever he would turn over a film to me, you always have an oh my God moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this is incredible. And the thing that I tell people, the best description I could give to sports fans, it's like being on a court on a fast break with Michael Jordan and he passes the ball to you at the last minute, you got to make the shot.
Come on, Pippen.
You know, so So when he sends me the films, man, I look at it and I go, uh-oh, I got to do some homework. And then seeing John David Washington in the beginning of that scene, you know, with the afro, the leather coat and the jeans, just brought back a ton of memories, man, of my youth growing up. And, you know, I just, was inspired by all of that, and that just that melodies kind of came to me. But you know, here's the thing about working with Spike: I'll send him a bunch of melodies, you know, and then he'll pick one and say, "Hey, man, I want this to be the main theme."
Yeah, and it was that movie. I know it got acclaim and it finally won Spike his Oscar for the script and everything. But I even so, I still think it's sort of underrated. I mean, the way he sort of recontextualized media, you know, opening with the Gone with the Wind crane shot, ending with, you know, some Charlottesville news footage and, you know, Trump footage and all. Like, I thought that movie was a piece of work, man.
The thing you got to remember was when the movie came out. You know, it came out during a lot of that stuff. So when we would hit the last part of the film, nobody expected that montage at the end of the film. And it was always a stirring experience for a lot of people to see that.
It was a warning that sadly almost half the country still hasn't heeded. I can't believe we're still, you know, dealing with that mess. I thought we'd get that out of the blood system by now. But anyway, we jumped ahead way far, but you mentioned John David Washington. I have to mention Malcolm X with Denzel Washington. what was your inspiration for creating that score? Because I remember even like when those opening credits come on, it's like a kind of patriotic sound, but with an edge to it. I don't know how to musically describe the anthemic quality to it. But yeah, what were you going for in creating the Malcolm X theme?
Well, man, when it came time to do Malcolm X, it brought me back to an experience that I had when I was a kid at a summer jazz camp with a guy named Willie Metcalf. We were playing a concert out in the park in New Orleans, and you know, I was like 14, 15 years old or something like that. And man, when we took a break, he put on a recording of one of Malcolm X's speeches. Revolution is bloody. It's going to be bloody. And I was a guy who grew up in a church and was all about Martin Luther King and didn't know much about Malcolm X at the time. And that speech scared me to death because I never heard anything that revolutionary talked about. And to see people out there in the park cheering it on made me feel like I was at something that I wasn't really privy to. I didn't know it was going to be this radical. So when you hear the opening of Malcolm X, that's my experience of hearing that speech for the first time. It's like that big crash at the beginning is like a shock of what I was hearing. And the heartbeat is the bass drum that you hear, and then, you know, the melody is kind of, the trumpet is kind of like Malcolm himself, and then the cello has a reaction to it that's kind of like me, and then it just kind of builds and builds and builds until the end.
Wow, thank you for musically breaking that. So the big crash is symbolizing what you felt watching the speech.
Oh, yeah.
Was Plymouth Rock landing on the soundtrack.
Yep. exactly.
That is fantastic. Thank you for sharing. And by the way, I do believe, as a, you know, film buff, I believe Denzel may have just been possessed by the spirit of the Malcolm X, the ghost. In those scenes, it's unbelievable.
Well, let me just tell you this. You know, we had just finished Move the Blues, and he was working on that, and I was talking to him on the phone about something, and I remember he started telling me he was working on it, and he went into the speech, and it was such an eerie experience hearing Malcolm's voice come through my phone, through Denzel. It was like he was channeling Malcolm, you know, more so than acting. It was like he became Malcolm in that film.
Oh my God. That's good. Channeling is the perfect word. Yeah. Should have won. If you ask me, but it was, you know, how it goes. Al Pacino had never won. They got to give him the makeup Oscar, you know, for Cinema Woman. But man, Denzel, I mean, good. Glad he got it for Training Day too. But to me, he should have had it for Malcolm as well. But the Hurricane, there's so many you could say.
I'm Bradley Trainer,
and I'm Don McClain. We have a podcast called Blinded by the Item.
A blind item is gossip about a celebrity with their name left out. It's a guessing game, and you can play along. The item might be like, this A-list star carries a Birkin bag worth more than the average person's house to the gym to work out.
Pretty sure that's J-Lo.
And P.S. the person behind all of this is Kris Jenner,
LLC. We drop a new episode every weekday, so the fun never ends.
Blinded by the Item. Listen wherever you get podcasts and watch us on the Blinded by the Item YouTube channel.
But anyway, obviously we don't have like time to go through all the Spike collabs, but I'll list them real quick, because Crooklyn, I love Crooklyn. Great coming of age story.
Oh, yeah, it's cute.
Spike's childhood all over that, probably.
Right.
Clockers is just a great, I know you worked on that. That's like a, just like kind of a cool crime, gritty movies, underrated. Four Little Girls, the documentary, Summer of Sam, Bamboozled.
Well, look, he doesn't get enough credit for his documentary work. I think he's one of the best documentarians I've ever seen. You know, when you look at what he did with When the Levees Broke, I mean, he captured so many different types of cultures that exist in New Orleans. It's more comprehensive than anything I've seen done on New Orleans.
I think it's the best thing ever made on Katrina, probably, a lot would say.
Probably,
And then Four Little Girls, yeah, of course, yeah. But, I mean, there's so many. Yeah. I mean, American Fiction won, you know, when that won this past year, and it's a great movie, I thought back, that was Cord Jefferson, but I immediately thought back to you and Spike doing Bamboozled, so, like, that sort of social commentary
Exactly.
But I'm come on, 25th Hour, Inside Man, Chirac, like the list of stuff that you've done with Spike is truly unbelievable. And we hit Black Klansman, and I guess to end with the whole Spike run, we got to mention your second Oscar nomination for The Five Bloods.
Yeah, that was a great film. I think Delroy Lindo got snubbed in that one, but you know, because I thought his performance was just amazing.
I mean, he's wearing the, you know, Make America Great Again hat, but then, you know, he's but then he's sort of like hugging the angelic Chadwick Boseman, which you all didn't know he was sick at the time, which is crazy to me. But there's like that comes down through the trees and the camera kind of circles around.
Well, you know, it's funny that you talk about that moment with the light coming down from the trees, because I asked Spike, I said, Spike, how'd you do that? He said, man, that was God. He said, that's just the way it looked at that time. We didn't set that up that way, you know? And when they saw it, they rushed to take advantage of it. You know, he said it was just a blessing, you know, that it just kind of went that way. And for me, just watching Delroy's transformation throughout the film was part of my inspiration for writing the score, you know? Because here it is, you have these guys that have had this shared experience, you know, and it's something that has stuck with them. And they were coming back there, you know, for monetary gain, obviously. But the big story to me was the camaraderie that they had, the will that they had to take care of each other to survive.
Right.
You know, that opening sequence in the film, that battle scene, was probably one of the most masterfully shot battle scenes I've ever seen in a film, you know, the way Spike put it together. And I still think, you know, it's one of his greatest works that he's ever done.
In a long line of many, my friend, and you've been literally the soundtrack of our lives, of all of us who've grown up, you know, watching, you know, I don't know where we're at now, over three decades of great films by Spike. You're the music under them double dolly shots, man.
thank you.
Well, so much groundbreaking work with that. Thank you for indulging us in talking so long about Spike. I really appreciate that. I do want to say, Spike has, and you have, you know, been groundbreaking, you know, and people of color directing, finally getting their due behind the camera. But also I want to commend you. I mean, you've also helped women directors, along the way in recent years. I mean, you mentioned Casey Lemons with, Eve's Bayou and Harriet, but also Gina Prince Bythewood. You did Love and Basketball and the Woman King, Regina King. You did One Night in Miami, which was competing against the Five Bloods that year. But, talk about, let's do the Woman King. Let's close out, because that man, I thought that movie was underrated as well. I thought that should have been up for Best Picture, if not competing for it, man.
I thought, you know, I thought that we were all really hurt by the lack of recognition for that film, because I thought everybody did an amazing job. The actors were just on point. Gina was on point. The trainers for the women, the wardrobes, everything. You know, when Gina brought me in to just view a cut of the film, she left me in the room by myself, man, and I was an emotional wreck watching it, you know, because I was so proud of what everybody had done. You know, it was one of the first films that had taken African culture and made it look so regal and noble to me, you know, that I was honored, literally honored to be a part of it, you know.
Yeah.
And when we got a chance to do the music, man, you know, I brought in some of the opera singers from my opera career, and then I asked a good friend of mine, Diane Reeves, to come in and just sing on top of it. And, Diane and myself, we both said, like, it felt like everything we experienced in our musical careers led us to that moment to make that film. Because as soon as she started to sing, it just, everything just fell into place. You know, it was like the one thing that was missing, you know, and but that we didn't realize, you know what I mean? Until she started to sing. And when she did, it was like, oh my God, that's exactly what we needed. So I'm very thankful to Gina for giving me the opportunity to be a part of that, because that's a film, you know, I'd like to, you know, my grandchildren to see, you know, for sure.
Absolutely. And Viola Davis, and like an all-timer performance in that, as well as everybody else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I still remember my wife, you know, we have our stack of, you know, award screeners or whatever that year, and we popped that one in and we were excited, but we looked at each other like, holy crap, that, and I put it my number one, I put it my number one movie of the year. I wish other people did.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Oh yeah. You know, we all critics, we do our top 10s, and that was number one for me. But, you got to go against the grain. Go with what you feel. Cause when you watch that, it was like, man, it reminded me of like an old Ridley Scott action, you know, Gladiator, like an epic battle movie, but at the same time with this social commentary, it was like, man, it was awesome. And, but you
know what? Viola Davis was amazing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? The scene where she's with the young girl, Maui, and she tells her, "You're not the thing that hurt me," it just floored me, you know, just watching that. Yeah. Their performances were just next level, man. And
yeah,
it was a shame that they didn't get the recognition that I think they deserve. But we have the film, you know, that people can still experience.
I think in, you know, maybe decades from now, people can pull up me talking to you right now, and they'll be like, oh, they were right. Because I really think, I think that actually they even just did a, I don't know how much you follow this kind of stuff, but they did there's a critic group called Sight and Sound Magazine. I think it's out of England or something. Anyway, every 10 years, they pull all the critics and all the directors in the world and all that, and put together this big list. And there's a lot of, you know, arty stuff on there that maybe is a little too highbrow for some folks. But anyway, every director lists their top 10. And I don't know if you remember Julie Dash, who made Daughters of the Dust.
Yeah.
1991. Mm-hmm. Very groundbreaking film.
Yeah.
She put The Woman King in her top 10 movies of all time. So,
oh wow, wow, yeah. Wow!
So I think that's high praise. Yeah. So anyway,
it is a huge honor. It deserves it for sure.
I think so too. Hey, do we have 3 seconds, final seconds, to give me something on Princess and the Frog? Because that's what all the kiddies know you for.
Man, Princess and the Frog was a lot of fun to do, man. You know, because my kids, it was one of the first films that I did for my youngest daughter that she really related to. She was a little girl at the time. And when I brought the music back home, and you know, the company Disney sent us a whole bunch of stuff for little girls, and she was just enamored by the whole thing. But for me, it was really great to see a lot of young girls of color have a hero, have somebody that they can look up to and relate to, you know. And we just did some music, you know, Disney is actually doing a ride for Princess and the Frog and at both of the theme parks. And they had me create music for like a radio broadcast for the queue line when you're waiting to get on the ride.
Oh,
and that was
wow.
A lot of fun as well. I can't wait for people to experience that too.
Man, they think of it, what do they call it? The Imagineers. They think of everything. Even when you're waiting in them long lines, there's like creative, you know, visuals and your part music going on even while you're waiting.
Yeah. And it's going to be done like a radio broadcast, which is kind of cool.
All right, folks, you hear that. Next time you go to Disney World or Disneyland, whatever, you can be regaled by the sounds of Terrence Blanchard while you wait. Unless you get your whatever, punch your fast pass, or I don't know how that works nowadays, but maybe they'll skip through your soundtrack faster.
Well, hopefully the music will be so good that they would want to get in the fast lane and want to sit there and experience the performances.
I think they need to make a Terrence Blanchard ride, just all of your scores throughout.
Oh, that would be crazy.
You could start with the Malcolm X. And then, you know, they go on there, and then by the end, you're when the roller coaster drops, it's bam.
Now that would be a ride.
Now we're talking. Well, thanks for this half hour ride, audio ride. I appreciate it. It's called Fire Shut Up in My Bones, folks. It's going to be at the Strathmore on Friday, April 26th in North Bethesda, Maryland. Get your tickets now. Terrence Blanchard, you rock.
All right, Jason. Thank you, man. I appreciate the time.
Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. Our theme music is Scott Buckley's Clarion. Remember to give us a 5-star rating if you like what you hear. We'll see you next time.